Hi there, and welcome to Oz Hour, the only place where you can hear everything you never knew about the wonderful and strange land of Oz.
That's right. Today we are coming to you with another very special episode of Oz Hour, continuing our coverage of Wicked, the life and times of the Wicked Witch of the West.
This is the sixth in a multi-part series, exploring the source material for the Wicked Broadway musical and the 2024 film adaptation. In this very special episode series, we will be covering the novel the same way we would cover any other Oz book, and we will be tying in references to the stage and cinematic musical throughout.
Not today. I'll tell you that much right now. We're your hosts, Blake Stone.
And Wyatt Swangham.
And as always, joining us is Hannah Agebe.
I am me. You are you. We are we.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we are here.
And they are they.
They are they.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very Beatles.
I wanted to say a poem.
No, you said a poem.
Maybe next time.
Those of you who have been joining us during this Wicked journey, you know that there's no Oz initiate because we've all read the book, seen the live production and the movie adaptation, and we did it all together.
True.
Yeah, you might call us fans.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight we are drinking Beekeeper's Brew, the recipe for which you can find on our Instagram at Oz Hour Podcast.
And what's in it?
This has a honey Earl Grey syrup, tikiki, fresh squeezed orange and lemon. And garbanzo bean juice instead of egg white to make it frothy.
Crazy.
Let's slurp.
Oh my god. Whoa. I like it.
I like it too.
I got really scared when you said garbanzo beans.
I saw your face. Part 4 in the Vincus, the voyage out. So we pick up 7 years after what happened last time.
Yeah.
Time be flying.
Time jump, which is just crazy.
When they said the life and times, they were not kidding.
And actually, and sorry to already go on a tangent, but like, how old was Elphaba at the end of our last sequence?
Oh,
how old is she now?
Like 22 or something.
Because it had been 5 years.
They would have been 5 years out of shiz.
Yeah, so she was...
She was 25, probably. Because she was in for 2 years. If she got there when she was 18, was there for 2 years, and then 5 years later, that would have been 25. So now she'd be 32.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
So.
Okay, 32.
Yeah. Young woman.
Sister Bursar of St. Galinda's Monterey takes out a huge iron key from her bosom, and she unlocks a store chamber and invites the seven-year Mont inside. So when the Mont comes in, she is given 3 black shifts, 6 camisoles, gloves and a shawl, her broom, a basket of simples, so herbs, roots, tinctures, balms for emergencies, and paper, which is scarce in Oz now. So she only gets a dozen pages, and she's given the instruction to make it last and make it important. And then to write on the paper, a fennec's feather quill, known for its endurance and strength, and 3 pots of black ink sealed with wax. So she's just got the simples to go on.
That's the longest list of simples I've ever heard. Yeah. What do you mean?
It fits in a basket.
Silk gloves, fennec feather quill, 5 pots of ink.
Yeah.
That's the Elphaba starter pack.
Yeah. Well, whoever this is, we don't know who yet.
Oh.
So we go out and meet Otsi Manglehand, who's a caravan leader, who is waiting alongside the Superior Mont. And we learn that the convent has given Otsi a good sum of money to take this 7-year Mont on their caravan with her. But she's skeptical when she's looking at the Mont, who is just sullen and kind of drab.
Well, it's also kind of weird. I mean, I don't know. To me, it's a little weird to be like, hey, here's a bunch of money. Here's like just some random Mont who's been here. Take her on your caravan.
Yeah, it's
it
like,
feels immediately suspicious.
Why so much? Why are the nuns getting rid of this person at such a high price? But the Superior Mont introduces the traveler as Sister St. Elphaba. She describes her as having spent years in solitude and nursing. She's very silent and not given to gossip, and she's ready to move on from the cloistered life.
Also, sorry, but it's kind of funny because, like, when you become Pope, for instance, you leave behind your normal name and you become, like, Pope John Paul or Pope Francis. And so it's interesting that, like, as a Mont, like, her name is Elphaba. But there's no way she fucking told them that. That's her, like, Mont name is, like, Sister Saint Elphaba. She could have been Sister Saint Galinda for, like, the, you know, if it was just
that
up to chance.
That is interesting. And it's Elphaba, the traditional spelling,
yeah,
beginning with an A, E. But yeah, I guess I didn't even think of them just choosing that name for her. I thought maybe she had said her name at some point once she...
Yeah.
Well, we'll learn a little bit about what time was like for her there. But she spent a lot of it silent. You're right about that. So Ötzi is telling Sister Saint Elphaba, like, okay, you're joining me on the Grass Trail Train Caravan. I cannot promise survival to the travelers. It is a very dangerous ride. Like, yeah. Ötzi's done it a bunch of times, knows that it's scary. But the Superior Ma affirms that Elphaba is leaving of her own free will. She can return to the Montre anytime she wants to, and she's ready for the trip. Elphaba is just kind of keeping her eyes on the ground. She's not responding. She's just very... She is not the...
Doesn't sound like the Elphaba I
know. Yeah, she's not the quick-witted, talkative girl we've known at Shiz, or even after with Fiero.
Yeah. It is probably similar to the Elphaba that was between Shiz and Fiero, though. Like, I don't think she was talking to a lot of people when she was underground
alone.
And hiding. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's true. And she was even, like, given to silent prayer during that time, too, because mm-hmm. she was in the church.
Although, I don't think she was praying. I think she was there to, like, get her, like, underground messages
she
and
was.
Stuff.
She
yeah.
was, because Fiora literally sees that cloaked person go and
yeah.
talk to her.
And then she, like, goes in there before she takes a bomb to the city. So
yeah, that's true. That's
I don't,
true.
But she was still silent during that. I just wouldn't characterize
prayer
it as prayer.
Comes in a lot of different shapes yeah. and forms.
Sometimes it's terrorism. So sorry.
The Superior Mont like bids Elphaba farewell, and while she's wishing her luck, we kind of learn that Elphaba is seeking atonement for some unknown sins or past mistakes that the Monts don't even know what these sins are. They just know that Elphaba feels like she needs to do this. And they're like, okay, good luck to you. If you decide to come back, you've always got a place here. But obviously, this is a part of your plot development. So before leaving, the Superior Mont pays Ötzi generously, which kind of implies to Ötzi that taking Elphaba along might come with some unexpected challenges. So the sisters say goodbye to their sister Elfie and go back inside to do their devotions. And Ötzi's like, okay, well, time to go. And like goes and gets Elphaba's things from the back of the cart and discovers a small, chubby, ragged boy sleeping behind Elphaba's luggage.
Yuck.
Yeah. And literally, Ötzi has like the response that you would expect some caravan driver just like in the city square to have. And she goes, shoo, go away.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Get out of here. You're not welcome here.
The boy, who I'm just going to say now, is later identified as Lear. He's claims to Ötzi, he's like, they told me to come too. Yeah. And so Ötzi is like, Elphaba, is that true? And Elphaba does not confirm or deny. She is still in her sullen, non-talking thing.
Yeah.
So Ötzi's like, no fucking wonder they gave me so much money. Mm-hmm. This is two people and they're fucking weird.
They snuck them in here.
Yeah. Tricked.
Yeah. So there's some unexpected responsibility coming on the caravan with Ötzi, but hey, anything for some money.
And he already said, you guys might die. So it's not actually that much more responsibility, because if the kid dies... Fucking so what?
People die.
Yeah, like that
day.
Is already out
they
there.
They can eat that.
But
boy.
They must have food
yeah,
on the
so
caravan.
Other people don't die.
Oh my God, yeah. And we'll find out way later, this is not a fit, scrawny little boy.
No, he's a chunker.
Chupster.
Lots of meat.
So the cloister of St. Glinda, the Elphaba's leaving, was located in Shell Shallows, which is southwest of the Emerald City.
Wow.
And Elphaba had spent 2 years in the city and 5 years at this outpost cloister. So the Monterey that she went to all bloody, she was there for 2 years, and then she got moved to St. Elphaba's Mont. So or St. Glinda's Mont.
I didn't put that together.
Yeah, I didn't realize that actually. I listened today.
So as they set out, Ötzi, you know, is just doing small talk pleasantries and is like, so do you still want to be called sister now that you've left the Mont? And Elphaba's like, Elfie's fine. And Ötzi is like, oh, what's that kid's name? And Elphaba's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So,
like, I don't know what's happening.
That's why I'm telling you up front, his name is Lear, because we're going to just learn kind of in passing that that's his name later on.
He is a person, okay?
He is a person. And Elphaba does not seem to know him.
Yeah.
When was the first time she saw him?
She's like, that's an object.
Yeah.
So they end up meeting up with the rest of the Grass Trail train, which consists of 4 wagons and 15 total travelers. and Oatsy outlines the route that they're going to take. It's not a short trip. They're going to go through Kellswater Edge, Cambrisia's Pass, the Thousand Year Grasslands, Kiamoko, past Kiamoko, and winter out beyond the Vincus. That's the full trip, and then it comes back. The Vincus is a wild, dangerous frontier with tribal groups that we'll learn about. They're the Unimata, the Skro, and the Arjiki. And they can pose threats. Other threats that can be posed are wild animals and even spirits.
Ooh, it's a wild land. And it's giving Quadling Country to me. Like, it's very much the same vibe of just, like, people that are, like, probably largely misunderstood, but the Quadlings seem generally more peaceful, whereas the Vincus seem more...
They're on survival mode.
Warlike, yeah.
Yes.
It seems like.
But you know what? Will, like, eat you.
Yeah. I guess it's up to, like, their, like, I guess, culture, because, like, the Quadlings are very, like, small family communities supporting each other. They live in a land that's, like, super fragile, and so they have to be stewards of it. They can't afford to fight each other.
The Quadlings are very knowledgeable about... their region.
Like, yeah, but the Vincus is like, we hunt, there's the Thousand Year Grasslands that are full of like sustenance, so the only thing stopping them from taking each other over is defending themselves. So right. I guess it makes sense that that would breed more of like a warlike people.
Yes, and that's the thing. Yeah, they're very warlike, but who's to say if they're not intelligent, because
yeah, I mean,
we don't spend time
Fiero maybe, let's say, you know, it's like it's not like they're like actually just, you know, mindless, you know,
and
war
they're intelligent
boards.
In other ways, like Fiero's tracking skills were pretty pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
If he didn't have those, he would have been alive.
Oh, fuck.
Sorry, but yeah.
So, geez, Oatsy's, you know, talking about the Rue and talking about, you know, some of the threats that could be out in these grasslands, and Elphaba's just kind of not fully processing any of it. She's fiddling with the Fenix quill that the superior Mont gave to her, and she's like drawing shapes in the dirt, like dragons and smoke patterns. And as we join the caravan, we kind of get this, we get a feel for Lyr and Elphaba's dynamic. Like, she pays him no attention. Oatsy, like, is like, maybe he's her page boy, because he's just like, he's tending to her bags. He's like, follows her around like a dog, but like, they don't talk to each other. They don't look at each other.
I love Oatsy trying to figure out like the dynamic. So it's like me as a server when like an old man and like a young girl come in and I'm like trying to figure out the situation.
Grandfather? Prostitute?
Oh my God.
He's the prostitute.
Yeah.
So. The caravan sets out at sunset. They set up camp after only a few miles because it's getting dark. The other travelers are all nervous but excited. We don't really get to know who these people are, but there's a lot of different reasons you would join a caravan like this, and they all have their own backstory that I'm sure they tell about. But some people are traveling for business, some for family matters, some to repay debts, and some for vengeance. Maybe that's in another book. I don't know.
Yeah, we won't hear about that. But
so we just kind of like get a lay of the land. The Vincus is very primitive. It's where the Winkies live. They lack refinement. They're feared as warriors, like Wyatt was saying. And just through all of this information, Elphaba just stays withdrawn. Everyone's like singing songs and socializing, and she's just like not taking part in that. So the caravan goes on and on as the days go, and Elphaba starts kind of like coming into herself a little bit more, but still keeping to herself and just kind of thinking about her past 7 years with the Monts. So her 7 years in the Montree consisted of, like, it began with meticulously cleaning floors while trying to avoid dipping her hands in the water.
Isn't that crazy?
It takes her forever. But she cleans a floor better than fucking anybody. It is a very thorough job.
You just think they could put her to... Because she said this was her first 2 years, which is doing that. Couldn't they put her to dusting? Or couldn't she sweep first?
Why does she...
But honestly, I think they saw that it's like... this bitch is meditating right now. Like, if that's what she, if she wants to do the fucking floor, if she can do the floor.
Yeah, she was like, I have no one watched her.
Yeah, she was like, I'm doing the floors today. Nobody told her to. Yeah.
She's like, I guess it's time to get the bucket. Oh,
damn.
Like, how do you solve a problem like Elphaba?
Oh, God, stop.
She also, some of the things she does in at the Monterey, she makes wine and she cares for the sick. And
that's like what she does mainly at, in the last 5 years. So like after she leaves the first 2 years.
Yeah. And I'll just, so yes. And cause she passed the time very quietly. So for 3 years, strict silence, 2 years, whispers. And then the final 2 years, full speaking voice doing infirmary work.
Mm-hmm.
But me in high school.
She's fucking super senior over here. But she loves that being in the cloister means like she doesn't have to be unique. Like there's a uniform, there's silence. So she can just pass the time away.
She loses her individuality.
Yes. And she kind of wants to.
Yeah.
So the time that she spends those last 2 years in the doing the infirmary work kind of shape her perspective, especially surrounding like death and nursing, because she starts to see death, like she sees the pattern of death, and like she knows it has a natural process, and she like, it's very like in Mean Girls, Catty Heron being like, yeah, math is real, like I love that because I can understand it, it's the same every time.
It's weird because it feels like every single time something positive is about to happen or on the way to that is when someone has died.
So true.
That is true.
It's like
the drought coming up, like not being. Oh wait, no. Well, no, that was because
Turtle Heart.
Yeah, and then they have a brother. I don't know if that's like positive for her or not. It's positive for the mom.
Yeah.
Dead mom.
Yeah.
Dead mom.
Oh, oh my God.
That is crazy though. Yeah, I hadn't made that connection.
And then Dr. Dilemon. Fucking, what is it? The owl.
They were just getting there with their
breakthroughs
studies.
Left and right.
Yeah.
Dead. Love, Furio, dead.
Yeah. Alma Clutch.
How could I have forgotten Alma Clutch? Wait.
I'm sure Glinda, Glinda was getting
friendship.
Used to her living situation. Yeah.
Yes. Friendship.
Friendship. Love it. Hey, it's a friendship.
Aww.
Aww. I already finished my cocktail.
Oh my God.
That's sorry. Good. So yeah, but the natural process of death, like Elphaba sees it as like first this, then that, then this. Like it's always
procedural.
It has this thing. So she felt at home in the routine of arranging dying patients' hands and reading them scripture that she found meaningless, but she knew it brought them comfort. And then the arrival of a familiar face changes everything. An old friend from Shiz is now dying in her infirmary and recognizes her. And this old friend is Tibbet of Tibbet and Crope, Crope and Tibbet.
Crope and Tibbet.
Tibbet, he's in a very bad way. He's sick. He's incontinent. He's skin and bone.
Yeah. His angels in America.
Crope and Tibbet are like, meant to be together, not apart.
No, both of their lives suck now.
Yeah, like Crope is a pet.
Yeah.
And Tibbet is
sick. And yeah. I do think, like, your Angels in America statement you just made, I do think that's kind of what it's giving, is that Tibbet is presumably a gay man. He is sick with something that is representing itself very much in the way that people are sick with AIDS.
Yeah.
And the last time we saw him was being penetrated in the philosophy club.
And this book was written in the 90s?
Yeah.
This would have been
during/after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do think that that is probably the way we're supposed to feel about it. And especially because there's so much, I feel like a lot of like stories you'll see in popular culture about the AIDS crisis as well. The people who are sick have so much hope and life in them. And that's part of what's so tragic about it. And I will say that with Tibbet being so sick, the book says he's still more alive than Elphaba was as a nun.
Yeah.
And he and he forces her to come back to herself and like talks to her about who she used to be and the things that they used to do. And he talks about the good times and he talks about the bad times because he's had bad times since they last saw each other.
I'm literally not okay.
And he like curses, you know, the so-called friends who abandoned him.
Yeah,
he's dying.
Yeah, he's dying alone in a Monterey outside of the Emerald City.
And
yeah.
Honestly, Elphaba is kind of that friend too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, she wasn't at
the philosophy club, I guess.
Yeah. She technically abandoned all of them, but nobody really was looking for her either.
Yeah.
That's true.
But that's true. And also, like, how did he get to the Monterey? Like, I feel like he was like probably scraped off the side of the street.
I know.
Oh my god.
But he forces her to engage. He treats her like she's an individual, and it kind of disrupts this whole non-identifiable thing she's doing.
She's like, past come in.
She was disassociating for the gods.
He pointed out to her as she was changing and becoming Elphaba again, he would point out to her that that's what was happening. Like, he'd be like, you're moving different. You're talking different. You have a different look on your face. And so, I don't know. It's just very like, I'm here in this bed. Do not let your life end because there's life out there. And she resents it because she was kind of had this thing
she
going.
Was vibing.
Yeah. And she's like, I guess you're right.
She also cannot ignore it. Yeah. So after Tibbet's death, and what's interesting is I don't think it's Elphaba's idea, actually. The way I understood it is that the superior Mont actually came to Elphaba, probably because she's noticing that she's
doesn't want to be there
not
anymore.
The same. Yeah. Yeah. And she's like, girl, you need to get out of here.
You got everything you could
time
from
to move
this
on.
Place. Yeah. And the fact that they are paying this insane sum of money for her to go shows that, I don't know, like,
they want this for her.
Yeah, they're like, Elphaba, you've helped us. Like, your service has been so important to us that we will shell out fucking untaxed tithed money to send you where you want to go. And it's like, but also with the idea of like, if you want to come back, you're always welcome. But like, you need to figure your stuff out because you're not where you want to be right now.
Absolutely.
Which I respect.
So these are the things that Elphaba thinks about every night during the caravan.
Yeah.
She doesn't sleep. She just like lays there under the stars, under the fucking comets, just staring at the sky and just thinking about these things. But one night while Elphaba's laying out, just thinking about the last 7 years and how life is, Otsi finds her and is like, oh, you can't sleep. I've noticed that about you. You're always awake. And Elphaba's still just like, she's grunting in response. But I think it's less here that like she just is not interested in talking to anyone. And I think honestly, she has all of these really complex thoughts right now. And she literally doesn't know how to say them out loud to people, especially people she doesn't like care to be talking to.
Yeah.
But Otsi tries to make jokes. Elphaba just barely responds. Otsi like starts trying to like talk shit about the cook on the caravan.
Yeah.
We will learn everybody ends up talking shit about at some point. But Elphaba like tries to engage, but she just feels detached. So she keeps staring at the sky and like she feels like overwhelmed by the stars and feels like they're trying to whisper something to her that she can't quite hear. And she just has the realization that there is too much hate and too much love in the world. And that's pretty much what all of these like thoughts about the last 7 years boil down to for her. So the caravan goes on for days. They finally reach the Kells Water, which is a forbidding, lifeless body of water with a gray cloud-like surface. And Otsi is like, yeah, horses refuse to drink from this water. Travelers don't go in this water. It has never been used to supply the Emerald City with water, even during the droughts.
It's like a man-made lake.
It's disgusting. And it's like the people called it dead water because it's just like gray and cloudy. And
there was like
gross.
This man-made lake in Reno called, was it the Marina, I think. And someone found a dead body in there once.
Shocker.
And they would still have like a little area for like kids to swim in. It was like, no one should be allowed in there. There's no, where does the water
water's
go?
Water's not going anywhere.
And there was like Tahoe. Just go to Lake Tahoe. It's right there.
Well, this is 5 minutes away from everyone.
And that's okay. Just
so there's also the dead bodies in there.
I was going to say, that's just the body that was found. I mean, there's probably other bodies
down
at the
in the
bottom.
Mud down there. Yeah. All sorts sticking out of the mud.
A ring?
Mm-hmm. No. Don't do that.
But even as disgusting and ugly as this, as the Kells water are, this kind of lavender mist is receding up in the distance, and they get their first glimpse of the Great Kells Mountains. And Otsi's like, okay, like, we're going into the Kells soon. Beware of Unimata hunters. I'm going to show you all how a fog charm works, because if somebody tries to attack us, like, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
a great example of sorcery in the wild.
Yes.
Yeah. And a way to, I feel like it's almost like commercial use. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, like how Galinda was like, people can use magic to like feed the community.
Yeah.
You
know? Like,
or like, protect the cows and stuff.
So the cows don't jump off of cliffs and stuff. Yeah, like this is an example. They're trying to get... He's trying to bring a group of people that are traveling and using this to make sure that people don't get killed and everyone makes it safely.
He bought this magic potion at the fucking like army surplus store.
Yeah, he stopped at Fred Meyer and grabbed a pamphlet
just real
this.
Quick before heading out.
But like the fact that he's showing them this, which also I actually think Otsi's a girl.
She is.
But the fact that she's showing them how to use this fog charm, like it's which she absolutely should be doing. Like they need to know how to protect themselves out here because Otsi can't do it all. But the travelers are getting nervous. But Otsi reassures them that like the Unimata, they can be allies if they're approached correctly. Like just because we bump into Unimata doesn't mean they're going to hurt us. Mm. So time goes on. We're entering the Kells. And we learned that the caravan includes 9 horses, 2 cows, a bull, a heifer, chickens, and a dog named Killyjoy, who Elphaba thinks is more of a Makejoy.
Makejoy.
What's a Makejoy?
Instead of a Killyjoy.
Oh, it makes.
She likes it.
Killyjoy is beautiful. He's a mountain breed. He's part Leinster Collie, Lynx Terrier, and maybe even a little bit of wolf. He's very energetic.
My favorite type of dog.
I know. I'm like, I don't know what any of those are.
But let me squeeze your little face.
He's very energetic. He loves to like chase rabbits and other prey around, but he never catches it, either because he doesn't want to and he's just playing or because he's bad at it. I do not know.
Yeah.
I think he might be a little bit bad at it because later he catches something that hurts him.
Yeah, but that's true.
But he's a very friendly dog. Everybody loves him. But usually
the cook's
the night,
dog, right?
The cook's dog. Okay. He is the cook's dog. And during the night, he just kind of hides under the wagons and keeps to himself. But some of the travelers suspect that Killyjoy might be an animal with a capital A. Mm-hmm. But Elphaba is like, are you fucking kidding me? Have you ever talked to an animal before? Which... mean.
I mean, honestly, but it's like the way that they're saying it is like that could be an animal. Like they're being gossips, and she's like, "Girl, well, like
I think they're saying it because he seems like he like
is strange,
is wise. It's just like
it's like is it like talking shit about him, or is it like?"
I think it's like they think he's like an animal in disguise, especially because maybe because of how the politics have changed in the area.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Are any of the other animals capital A animals?
None of them.
Okay, no. I didn't think
actually,
so.
Actually, it says like...
Something that happens later made me think no, but...
Because it says like 9 horses, 2 cows, a bull, a heifer, chickens, all without much personality. And then there was Killyjoy, the cook's dog. And it's like, I think that's where like the speculation comes from is because he's so different from the others. Yeah. But the others are livestock and one's a pet. So.
But also how many of these animals maybe used to be...
Well,
animals.
That's what I was thinking too. Was like with the other, especially because
how
the
long have these
ones.
Guys been alive? They could have been alive and then you know,
that's interesting.
Long enough to survive, but then it's like at a point they just forget how to talk.
Elphaba not convinced. She does not think Killyjoy is a capital A animal, but I'm starting to become convinced for whatever reason why. Lear, the little boy, loves Killyjoy. Mm. He's the only kid on the caravan. Mm-hmm. He probably wouldn't be very good at making friends anyway if he wasn't in a caravan right now.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
kind of strange.
Because he just kind of appeared. And yeah. where did he appear from?
It's really unclear.
Mm.
Like, was he living at the monastery?
Well, I was going to say, we don't even know.
Because he was just in the back of the caravan.
He could have made that story up. You know,
yeah, and Elphaba is not talking.
Yeah, she hasn't said anything.
One night, Otzi overhears Lear just like petting Killyjoy and being like, "My name's Lear. You can be my dog, sort of," which is just like sweet. And like Otzi's yeah. like, "Oh,
he's like, I'm a play pretend.
Every kid needs a dog." Mm-hmm. Also, that's when we learn that Lear's name is Lear. But
yeah.
I had to tell you sooner.
No, that would have been unsustainable.
as the days go on, Elphaba and the cook do not get along.
They get a lot of spats.
She thinks he's a butcher. Cook, he kills animals indiscriminately. Like when he cooks rabbits, she's like, "How do you know those weren't rabbits?" And he's like, "Oh, shut the fuck up, or I'll cook that little boy." How's that?
So he is a murderer.
And then literally goes to Otzi and like tries to get the cook fired, which I'm like, what is he gonna turn? Is he gonna take one of the wagons and go back by himself? Like,
yeah.
what's
yeah,
the
what does
plan,
that mean?
Phil?
I mean, so, someone else would have to cook, I guess.
Well, yeah, I think they'd be fine. I just wonder, like, are they really going to send him off into the wilderness because
by himself?
Elphaba doesn't like his attitude?
Here's a question, too, and I don't know if we know this, but is the cook part of the staff, or is he someone who's going in the caravan and happens to be a cook?
I think he's the cook. Like, I think oh. Otzi and the cook have done this before.
Because I kind of thought that he just happened to be a cook, and so he cooked all the meals.
That's what I thought at first, too, but I could see it being a... Well, I don't
mean,
know.
Either way... Well, she tries to have him fired. Mm. She goes to Otzi and talks about trying to get him fired, so that makes me think he works
okay. that
as
makes
part
sense,
of it.
I guess,
but either
yeah.
way, he needs to stay. He has to stay. He's got to stay.
Yeah. You can't get rid of someone in the middle of a journey on a caravan. If someone was trying to get, if someone was trying to get rid of me, after they just said they had to put a charm in this one place to not get murdered by these
oh,
people,
yeah.
I'd be like, no,
I'm, like, oh.
I'm staying
Nobody,
with you. I don't
yeah,
care if
I'd
everyone
be screaming.
Yeah, I don't care if it like I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, I'm staying and nobody's eating.
Yeah.
But yeah, Otzi's like, I do not have time to talk about firing the cook with you. Like, we're about to go into Cambrisia's Pass, so I've got other things on my mind. Cambrisia's Pass is going to be a big part of the trip. As they approach it, it's described as having like an unsettling eroticism. So like the pass that they go through...
So why is everything erotic in this book?
Gregory Maguire.
Well, I will say the Cumbric Witch is a topic that gets brought up earlier. And like they're like, oh, I think that like that woman at the philosophy club, they say there's a witch there tonight, a Cumbric Witch. Mm. So like there is some eroticism tied to the idea of the Cumbric
Witch.
Yeah.
And so this is Cambrisia's Pass, obviously Cumbric Witch's Pass.
And she's so it's probably
I guess that yeah. does that does make
yeah.
sense.
And because of the way it appears,
she's a
could
slut.
Be how it got that name. She is. So this mountain pass appears to resemble a woman lying on her back with her legs spread, welcoming the travelers.
Me.
lying on your back with your legs spread.
I do that all the time to travelers.
Oh my god.
Sorry, Charlie.
So as the travelers move through the area, pine boughs shade the sun, and there's a sudden shift in atmosphere. Like, the air feels heavy against the skin, like it's damp, half-laundered toweling. The tree's bark feels wet. The air is thick with moisture, like it's just muggy and, like, gross mm-hmm. and creepy in here. Once inside the forest, they can't see the hills, and it just, like, smells like greenery and dirt. Like, they are in the wild.
Yeah, which is crazy because I feel like they were kind of like out in the open for a lot
of like,
this. Even though they were like in forests, like they were
like going canyon prairies.
I guess so. I don't know.
Yeah, because
like they were
like
along the Kells Water, which would have been at a low
oh,
point.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Not giving
well,
foresty. Not a
no,
forest.
But
very
now it's
open.
Like rainforest.
Very open. Yeah. Now they're in the jungle. Yeah. Near a small lake, they see a dead tree that's home to a community of bees. And the bees are working on their chamber music and honey, which I thought was a really nicely written sentence. But Elphaba wants to take the bees with them. And she's like, hey, do you think I should go ask those bees if they want to come with us? And I'm like, what?
Yeah,
the way I would be so mad.
Also, since when does she talk to bees?
She's talked to many animals in her past.
Capital A animals.
Oh, is the beast that she met when she was saying horrors, that was a capital A animal?
I don't remember her asking that beast to do anything in particular.
Well, it didn't kill her.
True.
She does have a way.
She obviously has an animal thing.
Yeah.
I've just never seen her talk to an insect before, so this is just a little.
She talked to Malky.
Oh, yeah, Malky.
Yeah, that's true. She said Malky, Malky, meow, meow.
And that cat loved that.
Fed him spoiled milk.
That was his favorite thing. He lived for that.
Yeah. Every time she said Malky, Malky, meow, meow, he's like, we do learn, though, that like Elphaba has a fascination with bees. She had encountered bees in the kitchen garden at Crage Hall and at the cloister of St. Glinda in Shell Shallows. And she's just entranced by the existence and presence of bees. She loves them. Lear is terrified of bees. But discussion does arise about the potential benefit of taking the bees. So this old man heading westward to die, his name's Igo, he had a midnight vision that told him he needed to do this. He suggests honey would improve the taste of their sparrow leaf tea. And this Glickin mail order bride, who's on her way to meet her new family, she agrees. And Oatsy, who's known for unexpected sentimental enthusiasm, votes for having the honey because it's going to bring up morale. It's going to make everybody happy. So they're like, go ask the bees if they want to come with us. Mm-hmm. So Elphaba climbs up the dead tree and she asks the bees and they agree to come along in a swarm. So
do they answer like the way that the fishes in Finding Nemo answer everything?
Oh my god.
You know those fishes that
make arrows.
Make arrows. And they're like they spell out yes.
Yeah. That's what they do. That has to be it. Yeah. And so the bees join them, which makes everyone a little bit uneasy, but hey, they have honey.
Yeah, I'd
but
be like
yeah. Everyone like says if a speck of dust like brushed someone's arm, they'd be like,
yeah,
it
changed everything for everybody. Like there'd be nothing.
Because it was such a comfortable ride before.
Right, yeah.
But I must say I would do it for the honey.
Yeah, you're a freak about honey.
Fresh honey.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. Nobody's going to have allergies on this trip. So as they are going deeper into Cambrisia's pass, they get to a point where they can't really go any further without a Rafiki because there are certain...
A guide.
I will explain. Okay. But they can't pass through certain lands of Vincas tribes without permission and a guide. So they call a Rafiki using drums and mist. And then they just kind of wait for someone to answer the ad.
Mm-hmm.
So as they're waiting for a Rafiki to come, one night the caravan starts up a discussion about the Cumbric Witch. And the conversation turns into whether the Fairy Queen Lurline or the Cumbric Witch came first. Because, Lurline is all good. Cumbric Witch is kind of represents naughty. And the sick old man, Igo, he quotes the Ozzyad and explains how creation in Oz works when he says that the Dragon of Time created the sun and the moon, Lurline cursed them, making their children unable to recognize their own parents, and then the Cumbric Witch came along, followed by the flood, battle, and spreading of all evil in the world. That's all we get of the story, but it sounds like it's probably a big portion of their Bible.
Yeah. At least of the Ozzyad.
You have the Ozzyad.
Which they're like, that's just poetry. They're like, that's just a story people made up.
The Unionists follow the Ozzyad.
The Bible?
Well, the Ozzyad, but like. Well, yes. Yeah, it's right there. But no, but like, I thought the Ozzyad was more of just like a like poetic work, but I didn't think that was like the holy book.
I don't know.
That's interesting, though.
Maybe it just has
makes sense.
A lot of information about history, about all that type
it has
of
the
stuff.
Cultural
so,
context.
Yeah.
I mean, either way, fiction or gospel truth to these people, it's still like a topic of discussion where people are going to differ because Oatsy disagrees with this interpretation. And she argues that folk memory is truer than the Ozzyad, suggesting that evil predates good in popular lore. because evil in many folktales arises without explanation and good is usually a response to evil, which honestly sounds like a lot of the fairy tales that we have. It's like something bad is happening and the good comes and fixes it. It's not something good is happening and the bad comes to
I don't know. I would have to think about that because
what comes first, the good or the bad?
Good.
Discuss. But she does challenge the idea that evil is ever defined or fully understood and asks, like, for instance, she's like, can the devil ever want to be good again? Or would he stop being a devil? Like, if he thought about that. So it's just good and evil.
Yeah.
Long, confusing conversation for them. But probably a super interesting conversation when you're lost in the wilderness.
Yeah, and for Elphaba, honestly, to listen to.
Yeah.
Just with her obsession with good and evil.
And
souls.
This time, you know, we used to get these conversations in, like, a college and stuff, and now it's, like, these travelers, like, that are probably from all different places and backgrounds.
Yeah.
Kind of giving college a little bit,
actually,
but it's, like, they're all adults still having these discussions in this world. I don't know, yeah.
And some of them... Like, some of them were probably, like, so working class, like, they never really got the, like, shiz experience.
Yeah,
of
so they really have different experiences.
Like this, you know? Yeah. But Igo does kind of agree with the folklore thing, like, the point that Otzi's making. And he's like, yeah, because the Cumbric witch is considered the original model of evil in Oz. So any other witch in a story or real life or whatever is just seen as a shadow or descendant of the Cumbric witch. So like she is like the first evil. And this all this conversation reminds Elphaba of the scroll painting of the Cumbric witch that she saw at Three Queens, where the witch had the shiny shoes and was straddling a continent and either nursing or choking a beast, whatever
the beast.
That was.
The beast.
The beast. The cook, ever the asshole, mocks the idea of the Cumbric witch's existence. And he's like, I don't believe in her. I don't believe in Cumbrisia's past. Like, all this is bullshit. And Elphaba is like, the question is, does the Cumbric witch believe in you? And everyone's like, okay,
Classic. All right,
let's have a good time. This is getting, it's not fun anymore. Yeah. So they all start to sing and lighten the mood. But Elphaba, like, stomps away because she's irritated because it just reminds her of when she would try to talk about these things with Nessa Rose and Frex growing up.
Yeah.
And, like, how, like, they were so, like, they just didn't give her ideas the time of day and always disagreed with her. So she continues kind of the conversation in her own head, and she eventually decides evil is beyond proof. The Cumbric witch's existence is beyond proof. It's beyond the grasp of history. You just believe in it or you don't. The next day, the Rafiki arrives. He's a thin, balding man with battle scars, and he warns of potential trouble from the Unimata this year because there's a caravan from the Emerald City and it's conducting a winky roundup and raiding the area. And it says, like, it's unclear whether the winky roundup is referring to a local dispute, like somebody talked about someone's mother and now there's a big brawl going on, or something more sinister like slave trade and resettlement camps. I would assume the latter. Just since the Emerald City is involved.
Yeah.
Since we know their past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they tear down camp and they move on with their Rafiki. The forest is silent. It's really long. It takes half a day to get through. And sunlight occasionally starts to break through, but it always seems like off to the side. It's never fully illuminating their path. And it's just eerie. And they say, like, it's as if Cumbrisia is traveling alongside them, like hiding from tree to tree and behind the rocks and lurking in the shadows, just casting evil over them.
I will say too, in this part when they're describing like the quality of the light, it's like they describe it as like the sky just appears yellow. And I'm like, well, what's the color of the Vincus?
Yellow.
So I don't know if that's an Easter egg or just a happenstance that like the quality of strange light might always be yellow, but I do feel like that's kind of interesting. I mean, I know they've been in the Vincus.
Getting like dusty, deserty overcast from it, but also like, yeah, in a place where like it is going to reflect the yellow back. Because like in the original Oz books, it's like the purple land is purple.
Yeah,
the land
it just is yellow. But yeah.
No, that's a good observation. Everyone hates the forest. Igo, who's on his journey to die, he's like, guys, we have to get out of here. I cannot die here. My spirit will never find its way out of
he
here.
He really hates it though.
Everyone hates it. They pass the night, and in the middle of the night, the cook vanishes.
Mysterious.
Everyone speculates.
Who hated the cook?
Everyone.
Most.
But everyone is speculating wildly. They're like, kidnapping, sleepwalking, suicide, revenge from Cambrisia for speaking of her, you know?
Oh, he did say that she didn't exist.
So, like, there's a lot of theories emerging, but no answers. Alphabell couldn't give two shits. Does
like,
not
thank God he's out.
Care. I don't know who makes the eggs. Let's say it was her. Let's say she's like, oh, come on, stop your whining.
I think it was her.
That makes sense. The eggs are...
She's replacing him fully.
The eggs are runny and inedible.
Yeah. Everyone never hates mind. The eggs. Yeah. So that's. But she doesn't eat meat. For all she knows, those are capital C chickens and capital E eggs.
Mm. Well, it depends on if she thinks that an egg is an animal.
That's true, and she wouldn't.
She wouldn't. She's too smart.
Capital E egg.
Yeah. But only because they're not fertilized.
Right. That's true. So, you know, Killjoy likes to chase things around, but he never catches them. Well, he did catch something called a grite, and it gets so weak and sick from the poison that he starts to sleep 22 hours a day while he heals. The bees mysteriously just go into hibernation inside their tree trunk hive.
Oh, yeah, because they brought a chunk of the dead tree. Which is good. I mean, where else are the bees supposed to go? But
inside the Tin Man. and most of the travelers, like, they all just stop speaking altogether, like, afraid of being overheard by whom they don't know. But it's just the vibes are off here.
Sorry, but is this a bad time to mention that in the original Oz book, the Wicked Witch of the West sends wolves and then bees to go attack the friends? And so far, Elphaba has encountered and taken into her care a wolf. And a swarm of bees.
We're getting
and
there.
We're gonna obtain another
an additional thing. Yeah,
will...
just to say that's happening.
Yeah, we're building things in the Vincas. We got all of them in the Vincas too.
That's true too.
I mean, technically, Killjoy's from wherever Killjoy's from, but you know what I mean.
He's in the Vincas.
So by evening, the thick pines are starting to thin. It's transitioning into staghead oaks. The trees are having broader branches. More light is getting through. The sky does appear pale yellow, but the travelers are like, oh my God, we can see the sky again. They also reach a cliff edge and realize that they've been like climbing because they didn't really understand that because they couldn't see anything. Below them on the outside off the cliff stretches Cambrisia's Pass, which is a 4 to 5 day journey, which goes to the Thousand Year Grasslands. And everyone's just really happy about the open sky, including Elphaba. Like, she just feels her spirits starting to lift, which is good. So this night, they pass the camp, and in the middle of the night, the Unimata tribe arrives.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of an attack, they come bearing gifts of dried fruit and singing tribal songs. They dance. They, like, make the travelers dance with them.
And everyone's, it's the middle of the night, so it's actually really scary.
That would be so scary.
Like, dance, pretty boy, dance.
Yeah. The travelers literally feel more terrified by their hospitality than they would have been if they were attacked. They're like, do we use a fog charm right now?
Yeah, So confused.
But Elphaba just kind of watches the Unimata, and they're just like soft and compliant and youthful, like schoolgirls, is what she notices. And their features remind her of the Quadlings that she grew up with.
There you go.
They have long lashes and narrow elbows and supple childlike wrists and oblong heads and thin lips. And she thinks like maybe they're distant cousins ethnically of the Quadlings.
Mm-hmm.
The Unimata depart in the morning. They pass the night there, depart in the morning, rudely complaining about the runny eggs because the cook's still missing. The Rafiki is like, yeah, okay, well, there won't be any more trouble from them. And he almost sounds disappointed because he's like, what am I even doing here if the Unimata aren't going to attack? Like, there's going to be chill.
Yeah, it would be embarrassing if you're like, yeah, you guys definitely need me because there's like, there might be trouble up here down the road. And then they literally bring them gifts.
And they dance.
Yeah. They teach them a new dance and bring them gifts.
So they continue down into the pass that day, and later, like as the day goes on, a Unimata messenger bumps into them and has news. A body has been found at the base of the cliff, and it's believed to be the missing cook, but the corpse has so many swollen lesions all over its body, it is unrecognizable.
Interesting.
So,
and as we know, the bees have been asleep.
Swollen?
The bees have been dormant, though.
Someone,
they've been sleeping.
Oh, they were hibernating?
Yeah.
Someone is
because they were busy killing.
Oh, we're fucking exhausted.
Someone is immediately like, oh, so it was the bees. And Elphaba's
bees
like,
die when they sting you.
They do.
It depends on the bee.
And Elphaba, she is like, oh, that's fucking rich. Like, fuck you. Like, there's so many flaws with that. The bees have been asleep for days.
You guys would
days.
Blame the bees?
Yeah, we would. You know what? No more honey for you. The bees have been asleep for days. If they had attacked anyone, started stabbing them multiple times with their stingers, they probably would have screamed. And she's like, oh, or did they somehow fly down his throat and sting that first so it was too swollen to hear him scream? Come on, people.
Think.
The accusations linger. The true implication is clear. They think that Elphaba bewitched the bees to kill that man.
Yeah.
She sarcastically mocks the superstition, but she's also like, I don't fucking care what you guys think.
Yeah.
So the caravan continues its descent. The sky fully opens up again. The air is brisk and autumnal. The horizon stretches out endlessly. And the plains below them are like flat as a lake. The wind moves over them in strange swirling patterns. The wind. Death.
Just saying, wind.
Oh, yeah.
And from a distance, tribal fires are visible, and they're like almost out of Cambrisia's pass. So the Rafiki points out the smoke that's rising in the distance, and at first everyone's like, oh no, like it's a dust storm. But Otzi is like, no, that's the fires of like a huge camp. And they learn that they are getting close to the Skro.
That's right, the Skro.
It's hunting season. There's been no large game seen anywhere, just small things like hares and grass foxes. Killyjoy's thrilled about this. Very excited to go chase some small things around. As they approach the Skro, they are scared more than they were of the Unimata. Because the Skro are kinda... I mean, even the Rafiki is cautious, and he seems less confident than he was when the Unimata were going to happen. Everyone's super afraid of the Skro. I'm not really sure why, but that's where we're headed, and we're going to find out why. Lear is idolizing the Rafiki. He thinks the Rafiki is so cool, which Elphaba finds silly and embarrassing. And she has this thought about humans and children in particular, how they're constantly changing out of shame or a desire to be loved, while animals simply are what they are and just live in greater peace. But I'm like, is that true for capital A animals too?
No.
Yeah.
I think she just means animals lowercase.
Okay.
Oh, that they just accept.
Yeah, that they just are what they are. Because I'm like,
I'm just like, she's obsessed with animals.
She is. She's like, just go obsessed. Back to the Monterey, girl.
Yeah.
It's not good for you out
what
here.
What do you mean?
So as night falls, as they come out of Cambrisia's pass, Elphaba starts feeling something unexpected, which is pleasurable expectation. She forgot what it feels like to be excited. And she's just excited to like see where this is going and what the Skro are going to be like. And the next day, they get to the Skro camp at noon. And a committee of Skro men and women are waiting at the border on horseback. And they're wearing blue ribbons and ivory bangles.
Ooh, just like Fiero's blue diamonds.
Yes.
Mm. Blue, interesting.
And actually, she does have an observation about them later, I think. I'll find it in my notes when I get there. The elder of the group is this large old woman who's being carried in a palanquin, which has a veil on it, and it's covered in amulets and tambours. And
what are tambours?
I don't know. I pictured like little like medals on string, like, you know, those little like coin looking ornaments.
Yeah.
So two crows sit shackled to her ornamental collar, and their feet are linked in gold. And there are traces of fruit and crow poop, like, on her collar and down her. She's introduced as the Princess Nestoya, She is an unconventional and filthy ruler, but she also exudes...
And she's huge.
She's enormous.
I know we already said she's, like, large, but, like, she's, like... Like, the fact that there's two crows that, like, sit on her shoulders and, like, shit on her all day, yeah, and she's covered in fruit...
She's like a giant.
It's because she's big.
Big and saggy and, yeah, just, like, enormous. How and they hold her up, I couldn't tell.
At first glance, or at first impression to Elphaba, it is a little bit, like... Gross might be a strong word, but it's like, oof, weird.
You don't like, see things, yeah, like that.
It's not exactly noble looking for but a
they
queen.
They do say that she exudes like her own certain dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And the travelers, despite their biases, they're like, hey, we are strangers here. So yeah, they just genuflect to her the way that they would any other ruler. And Astoria just like cackles in laughter and orders the Scro to carry her away. She's like, I don't want to see these people anymore. They're gross.
Yeah.
The Scro camp, it's structured in concentric circles, and the princess's tent is at the center, and it's elaborately decorated with like silks. And her concubine husbands, who are these mm-hmm. like timid scrawny
babies.
Scro men, they live in the nearest circle outside of hers. And we learned, like, the camp is big enough to fit 1,000 people, which is, like, 400 tents. And most of the travelers in the caravan decide to just stay in their wagons because they're like, what is this place? I hate this. Yeah. Elphaba, she's curious. She's restless. She explores the camp. People, the Scro, like, tribe people see her. Her skin causes adults to shy away, but the children gather around her excitedly, like with curiosity. And within 10 minutes of exploring the camp, she has a noisy entourage of 60 children trailing behind her, which is cute and also kind of scary.
It's army.
Yeah.
But that evening, some senior Scro dignitaries meet with the caravan leaders, and a small group is selected to visit the Scro shrine, which is an hour away by camel.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And by camel?
By camel. They ride camels, and they take torches in like the dead of night to this place,
what
which is
heck?
What's about to happen.
That's crazy.
This is the mummy.
Yeah. So a small group is selected to visit the Scro shrine, which is an hour away by camel. And the chosen to go are Elphaba, possibly because of her green skin or because she was brave enough to like wander the camp alone. Otzi, the Rafiki. Igo is chosen for his age. And some fucker named Pinchweed.
Pinchweed.
Yeah, Pinchweed.
That's the... Oh, wait. Pinchweed. He's the guy who's like in a... He's like a businessman.
Financial...
He's going out there to make his fortune.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the group takes off on camels. It's nighttime, mind you. The group takes off draped in glittering caparisons, and they're traveling under moonlight. They've got torches. So eventually, after an hour, they reach a carefully tended grove of trees arranged in concentric circles, just like the Scro camp's design. And the shrine's interior consists of curving corridors of brush leading to an inner sanctuary, and the sanctuary is lit by oil lamps that are hammered onto posts. So they've built this, like, interesting indoor-outdoor kind of sanctuary space. Princess Nestoya stands in the center. She's leaning on walking sticks. This is the first time we're seeing her support herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she's surrounded by massive sarsen stones resembling a stone cage. And sarsen stones are, like, Stonehenge.
Okay.
So she wears a mix of tribal leather and grass, enhanced by a striped purple and white towel wrapped around her body. It, because of the colors, it looks like something she probably traded from a traveler. Crows fill the area. They're perched on the stones. They're on her. There's 20, 30, 40 crows in the sanctuary. And the travelers participate. They spend the night participating in like a ritual meal, drinking, and they smoke from a pipe shaped like a crow's head. Like it's just this whole like tribal ritual.
If someone's obsessed with crows.
Yeah.
It's like the girl that loves purple.
I know. it's like kind of my whole thing.
It's like purple everywhere.
And that girl seems like she wore purple nail polish the other day, and I'm going to be really mad about that. Then, as the ritual goes on, and after they've, like, smoked and drank, a droning chant begins to like fill the space. And when the chant ends, Princess Nastoya drops her towel and she transforms before them into a whole ass fucking elephant.
Yeah.
Like, that's why she was so big.
Yeah. And why she has bird shit.
The disguise is not working, honey.
Yeah. Also, we didn't mention this, but like when it's describing her as a human, it says she has like kind of an overlapping upper lip that almost folds back on
like
itself.
Droops down.
And yeah, it's like an elephant trunk. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. And I will also do want to just emphasize that it's like mystical. It's not like take her towel off and all of a sudden.
No.
It's like she's. It's like.
It's like. Oh.
Yeah. Everyone is like, oh my God, I'm witnessing a god right now.
And they're high as fuck.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This is the winky version of the Philosophy Club.
I want to get super high and see one of you guys turn into an elephant.
I'll tell you it has to be a stranger. I do not ever want to see anyone I love turn into something like that. So Nastoya, now that she's an elephant, she can't like speak to them, which actually we've never heard her speak at all. But so maybe she just never does speak. But she uses the Rafiki and like speaks through his mouth. And speaking through the Rafiki, she asks each traveler about their true intentions. Like, why are they in the caravan? And Pinchweed says, money and commerce, pillage and plunder. And he realizes like, oh, that was like my honest answer. I wasn't trying to do that. That wouldn't have been my first thought to do. It's like everyone is answering honestly without meaning to. Igo is like, I'm looking for a place to die peacefully. Otsi says she's looking for safety and freedom from men's control.
Mm-hmm.
Elphaba says her true intention is to ensure the safety of her lover's surviving family, face his widow and guilt and responsibility, and then disappear from the world.
There we go. Yeah. That's why we're here.
It's giving Galadriel looking into everybody's brain to like know what they want.
Oh yeah, literally. Okay, Nastoya.
Nastoya sends everyone else away so that she can speak alone with Elphaba.
Except
for the Rafiki, because that's her mouth.
Yeah.
For
part of it.
And I love too because she addresses Elphaba and she calls her daughter of the dragon.
Yeah, which like, is like, oh,
how do you know?
Literally.
I really like the princess.
I love Princess Nastoya.
Yeah. But she
and
does cool.
Can I also remind everybody of the elephant skull that was in Elphaba's house for some reason with flowers
pouring out of the
hole in it?
I will say, I
still don't understand the significance, but there was an elephant skull.
That was
an accident.
When we got there, Nastoya did cross my mind, but I couldn't make. Like, I would have said something about it if I had any idea, like, why.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you brought it up now that we're, like, here and we have two elephants.
Here's the elephant.
Nastoya describes her situation as, like, her being under a spell. And she knows that the spell can be broken, but she chooses to remain in her current form as a changeling for her protection.
Yeah, it's not safe to be an elephant in the world right now.
Yeah.
Elephants are killed.
They're hunted
capital
in these
E
times.
And lower E.
Yes, and they don't care which is which. They want the ivory, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, and that's interesting, too. The Skro tribes people were wearing, like, ivory bangles.
Mm-hmm. And she explains that they've always worshipped elephants.
Yeah.
They probably got ivory from like dead elephants.
Yeah, that's true.
Just over time.
Yeah.
But Nastoya like reflects on the danger of being a changeling in the world. And she explains that elephants, like you were saying, Wyatt, they're hunted in these times. And she's seen as like vulnerable because of her magical form. So nobody wants to hurt her. But she does say that the Skro approve of her. They've worshipped elephants since the time before language and before history. And they know she's not a goddess because when she first transforms, Elphaba's like, an elephant goddess.
Yeah.
And Nastoya's like, I'm not a goddess. Like, I am a beast who chooses to present as a person for my protection.
It is, I think, important, though, to, and like she's saying, to recognize the Skrow don't think she's a goddess. They're not like, you must be a god.
They
they're
don't
like,
worship her because she's a goddess. Yeah. They worship her because she is an elephant.
Yeah, they're like, oh, like you're an elephant. We've always done that. So it just like, it emphasizes like the idea of like, oh, the Skrow and the Winkies, like they're not like mindless like fools who are just like, oh, elephant goddess. They're like, yeah, no, like we get it. Like, and we'll give you shelter because like,
tradition.
Yeah, it's like we've always like, elephants, yeah, so like
we're
yeah.
not fucking racist,
so that's
like,
kind of fun too,
be symbiotic here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so Nestoya is just like blowing Elphaba's mind and like saying, it is more important to me to protect myself and to blend in this way than to have my full freedom in my like true elephant shape.
Yeah.
Which She's saying something to Elphaba's heart here. And she tells her, I took this quote, when the times are a crucible, when the air is full of crisis, those who are the most themselves are the victims, but the choice to save yourself can itself be deadly. And Elfie is gagged and gooped. And she's like, okay, this is me. I'm not fully getting how, and I think maybe we're not entirely even supposed to really know how yet. But if anyone has any ideas on why that's important for her to hear, I'd be happy to have it on the airwaves. Okay.
No clue.
I mean, sorry, I'm trying to like, I'm trying to digest that quote and then think of like a literary response to it. But
yeah, like when times are changing, when things are terrible, those who are the most themselves are the victims, but the choice to save yourself itself can be deadly.
Well, I guess if the remedy to being yourself and being a victim is the choice to save yourself, which means to be somebody else, then that means that not being true to yourself can be deadly, even though it saves your body.
So find what's right for you.
But like, but then at the same time, then Princess Nestoya is literally being something else to save herself, which is being deadly
right
to herself. So I guess it's like both.
Like over time, not being yourself, the stress of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The stress of it is going to kill you.
That's interesting, too, actually, because like I feel like Elphaba has been herself to save others, but like is going to fuck everybody by doing so sometimes.
I guess so.
Like, she's like
before she went to the Monterey, quite specifically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. I just thought that quote was really nice, and I just think Nestoya's preaching here, so I wanted to share as much of it as possible.
Nestoya's just out here preaching.
But she gifts Elphaba 3 crows as her familiars and tells Elphaba...
Crows. There we go. The third one in the world.
Who remembers my crow story?
Oh my god, episode 1?
Say it in the comments. Yeah. The whole story.
word for word.
Hannah's words. But yeah, so she gives her 3 crows as her familiars and tells her that she is now a witch in hiding. Elphaba's pretty shaken by the word witch. She wonders what her father would think. And Nestoya says that they share the same enemy, and she promises that if Elphaba sends the crows, she will come to her aid if she's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So Elphaba is just... I mean, all of this is very heavy and very emotional for her. She also hasn't spoken to an animal in over a decade.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And also, at this point, I'm pretty sure the Princess Nestoya is speaking actually directly to Elphaba. I don't think it's through the Rafiki by the end.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. There was a point where it said that she starts speaking herself.
Oh,
yeah.
I missed that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Because she's always been able to talk to animals.
She's a capital A. So
I think Elphaba.
Elphaba
is
a capital E.
Lowercase H. Like, it's like because of her ability to communicate with animals.
Oh.
That's fine. That's fine if she's always been able to do that. I just think like 3/4 of the way through the book is a weird way to introduce it without saying, oh, and by the way, she could always do this. But now
maybe she's more powerful.
Now we have bees.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, it did say.
The time of the Monterey not speaking at all.
It did say.
It's powerful.
Or the book said, like, it had been 20 years since, like, she had spoken to an animal or something like that.
So anyway, on a more important note, Elphaba asks who enchanted Nestoya, but the elephant won't tell her because she fears that killing the enchanter would reverse her spell and put her in danger. And Elphaba's like, well, is life worth living in the wrong form? And Nestoya tells her that the interior self remains unchanged unless corrupted by self-obsession, and warns Elphaba, be not afraid of self-involvement and also beware of it. And Elphaba's like, oh, that's fine because I don't have an inner self. And Nestoya's like, that's interesting because someone told those bees to kill that cook. And Elphaba kind of recoils because she's like, did I do that? Like,
she said, excuse me?
She's like, am I... Did that really just happen? She's like, am I strong enough to make a bunch of bees kill a guy in the night? Nestoya's like, I heard the bees. Your power is real. So
I'm just putting that together. Wait, do elephants have really good hearing?
Yeah.
Okay, I just put that together. That's crazy. So I'm like, okay, I guess she can hear bees too. I didn't think about her being like she's a fucking elephant.
Yep. Yeah.
Great. She doesn't forget anything.
Great hearing,
either.
Big eared bitch. So as their conversation's coming to a close, Elphaba pleads to stay with Nestoya. She's like, you fucking rock, dude. Like,
yeah, like you understand me.
Teach me.
Yeah. You understand my inner self.
You told me new things about me.
Yeah.
But
no one's ever done that before. But yeah, so like she's saying, like she's like, I only want to do no harm in the world. I just want to stay here with you. And Nestoya's like, but you have unfinished business with Sarima. And she tells Elphaba, like, just go do what you got to do, girl. Like, yeah. That is going to be more important than staying here with me and talking to an elephant all day. And before she leaves, It would be nice, though. It would be awesome. Just live with the Skrow. Be so fucking skinny.
I mean, you're literally talking to an elephant woman, but you're like, but I'd be so skinny.
At least I'm not an elephant.
She eats.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, everything in comparison. She just feels so small. But before she leaves, Nestoya kind of like puts her trunk around Elphaba's shoulders, and she tells her, nothing is written in the stars, not these stars nor any others. No one controls your destiny. Which I included because in this book, we will learn there are individuals who think that they have control quite specifically over Elphaba's destiny.
I mean, I feel like we've already had one example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my god. I was thinking Matamorable.
I was thinking Matamorable too, but you're right too.
It is Yakel too. Well, but in a like, but yeah.
So these are important words for her to hear, and she's literally just speechless. So after the best fucking night ever, the group returns to the camp, they take their camels back, and despite like her inner turmoil, like Elphaba feels just restored, and she's like, oh my god, like I'm on the right track. I'm doing like what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. Life is gonna work out. Next day, the caravan continues along the grass trail train. Igo dies and is buried in a sandy mound. And Elphaba performs a brief ceremony. And she says, give his spirit movement and flight. Mm-hmm. And
defying gravity.
But wow. The Rafiki reveals that usually when Nestoya like has guests come and visit her at her ritual, there's usually a ritual sacrifice. Like that's what's happened before.
And he says specific, and I think it's specifically because of those like Emerald City raiding parties, because he said like it's as a revenge for like you guys can come
for the
here.
Winky roundup,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Like it's like, but like because people are being shitty to her, she will be shitty back and kill one of the people.
Which actually
makes
sense because he says Pinchweed would have been the most likely candidate to be the sacrifice. But his honesty saved him. And alternatively, when Nestoya was talking to Igo and he like sensed his impending death and like came and was like at peace with it, Nestoya took pity on him. And so I don't know if they're saying she caused his death or if she just saw how close it was and was like, that's as good
that's
as
fine.
Yeah, probably that, honestly. Only because, like, I don't think she, from a distance, like, I don't think she's, like, magic, you know?
Right.
So I feel like she was like, okay, you're out here about to die. Like, I'm not going to torment you in a ritual murder.
Yeah, maybe sacrifice anyone because she liked everyone that came in.
Yeah, also
like,
that, yeah.
Tonight's not a sacrifice night. Everyone's just chilling.
Yeah. This is the antithesis of the philosophy club.
That's so true. So they move on from Igo's funeral, literally RIP. This is like the third time reading this book, and Igo has never left an impression on me. I think because I like dived into this section recently, I was just like, RIP.
I know.
People be dying. As they go along, this caravan journeys on. The crows that Nestoya gave Elphaba start to become annoying as fuck. They're pestering the bees. They're shitting on the wagon. They tease Killyjoy. And it's just funny because it's like, nobody has an opinion of Elphaba. And then it's like, now she has bees. And it's like, now she has crows. Like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this sucks. Like, it's not a comfortable ride.
Yeah, I'd be a little annoyed.
So we've lost Igo. And now we lose the Glicken child bride who's been on the grass trail train with them. Mm. She departs from them. She goes and meets her like toothless old widower. He has six children who like all start jumping on her and they're like, Mom, Mom.
Oh my God. The way that I don't even remember that at all. Like, are you making that up? Because I literally have read this five times. Here.
She's reading.
Oh my God.
Six motherless children.
That's crazy.
And so now the traveling party is down to 10 people. Then the group enters the Arjiki tribal land. The first band of Arjiki they encounter are nomadic shepherds. And they're Arjikis, but they're less grand than Fiero was with his blue tattoos. But they're still striking to Elphaba. And their wildness and otherness like cuts deep into her heart. And she just, it's kind of like, you know, like those memes where it's like someone is looking at like a veiny Snickers and they're like, everything makes me think of him. This is her that.
Okay. I get that.
This is her that.
She feels like she's being punished for her past until the day she dies.
That's crazy.
So now only two wagons remain in the train. In wagon one, there's the Rafiki, Otsi, Lear, Pinchweed, and a Gillikinese mechanic named Kalp. And I'm like, stop introducing people.
Yeah, not good with names.
In the second wagon, it's just Elphaba, the bees, the crows, and Killyjoy. Yeah. Like, they're like, bitch, get back there. Like,
wait, where's fucking, where's Lear?
He's in the first wagon.
In the first, okay, sorry.
Everyone likes Lear.
Literally everyone is already calling Elphaba a witch, like up in their wagon. They're like, oh, is the witch still back there? Is she good? And Elphaba, she's like, sounds kind of good. I kind of like that. Kyomoko is 1 week away. And as we know, like on the caravan, like it's Kyomoko, and then they're going to camp past in the Vincas wilderness.
I'm like, we know where she's going now.
She's going to Kyomoko. So the terrain becomes steep as winter is approaching. And Otsi's plan is to winter in an Arjiki camp before heading back to the Emerald City in spring. And just like thinking about the Emerald City, Elphaba's like, I should send a note to Glinda and just like let her know that like I might, but she doesn't. She decides not to. Which honestly, I'm like, don't think of her. You guys aren't friends anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One day, Otsi is like teasingly calling Elphaba Sister Elfie, like the Monts were doing when she picked her up. And she's like, oh, you ready for breakfast, Sister Elfie? And Elphaba is like, I am no longer a sister. I am a witch. And Otsi's like, okay.
She's like, this has changed you, this trip. Yeah.
Who can say if you're changed for the better? You are changed on this trip.
She's like, it's not Elphaba, it's Laugh now.
Oh my God.
But Elfie like tries to like direct poisonous thoughts at Otsi like she did to the cook. And Otsi's just like, bitch, don't look at me like that. Like, what are you doing? And just laughs it off. So they're all literally, I don't know how long this trip has been. It's been weeks at least, but they're giving like, everyone's very comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
The group stops at a tarn, a small mountain lake, and others find the water refreshing. Elphaba doesn't really do that. And in the middle is a tiny island with a single leafless tree in it. Killyjoy, all of a sudden, just plunges into the water and starts swimming toward the island and runs out into the grass and clamps his teeth onto something moving in the grass.
Onto something's skull.
Everyone is freaking out because they're like, is that a fucking baby?
But then he lets go for a second, but only so he can get a better grip and get it further into his jaws. Which is just like, yeah, he does like the classic dog, like,
ha, ha, ha. you gotta readjust a couple of times.
I hate.
But as we know, he's very catch and release. Without thinking, Elphaba moves toward the water. We all know she doesn't fucking do water, but she sees a life in danger and she runs. And as she like runs, she expects to go into the water, but her feet make contact with a hard surface and ice is forming beneath her feet as she runs and create a bridge to the island for her.
She's a waterbender. Yeah.
It's Katara.
The others in the party just assume that it's some like residual magic from like another passing wizard or witch who was there before them. But she gets to the island and she pries Killjoy's jaws open and she saves the creature, which is a baby snow monkey.
Mm-hmm.
It has big black eyes and she assumes it must have been abandoned or accidentally separated from its tribe.
And are there wings?
No.
Just
a snow monkey.
Just a monkey.
It does not like Killjoy, but it enjoys the warmth of the wagon.
Yeah.
Because it's in Elphaba's animal wagon now.
Yeah.
They continue their caravan. I feel like I've said that so many times this episode, but this is the caravan episode.
Yeah, we're in the caravan.
The group camps on the perilous slopes that lead to Kiyomoko, and the castle like looms above them. It's dark and angular with towers and battlements and arrow-slit windows. It was originally designed as a waterworks by the Ozma Regent to funnel water into the center of Oz during the droughts, but Fiero's father seized the area and made it the seat of the Arjiki princes. So the next day after camping, Elphaba's like, by the way, this is my stop, and starts packing her shit up. The group say their goodbyes. They make toasts. They even express some regrets. It's like people are actually going to miss her, even though the bitch has bees and crows.
And a monkey and her dog.
Like, it's going to be like comfier, but fun. It's you like, made it interesting.
Yeah. And the bees like kind of start coming out of their hibernation. And they're humming. The crows can tell like something different's going on. And they're refusing to eat. Killjoy is mad that she took the monkey away from him. So he's like sulking. And the snow monkey, who we are naming Chistery because of Chistery. The way he chitters and chatters. Mm.
Chistery.
Sounds like a similar name to a monkey in the movie.
It sure does. Wow, we actually do have a connection.
I guess we do.
I've been waiting.
The one connection.
That.
Yeah. So as we know, in the musical, Chistery is the OG flying monkey.
Yeah. General.
General. I'm going to say it happens a little different, but
yeah, we'll get there.
So as everyone prepares to leave, Lear arrives with a parcel of clothes and some musical instrument. And Elphaba is like, oh, bye, Lear. Like, nice. It's been nice. And he's like, what? He's like, I'm going with you. And she's like, you're going with the crows, the monkey, the bees, the dog, and the witch. Like, why? Like, and he's like, where the hell else am I supposed to go? We came together. And so he's like, kind of starts begging her. And he's like, I can take care of the dog and I can collect the honey. Like, I'll clean up after the crows. Like, I'll help you. And Elphaba, literally, she's like, I don't care. Like, she's like, just if you're coming, then come, whatever. So Lear's like, all right, I guess, and stays with her. Like, he's like, I thought we were friends now, but all right, fuck you.
Good to know this meant nothing to you.
And so they say goodbye to everyone else, and they approach Kiyomoko. And with that, Lear prepares to enter his father's house.
Ooh, what could that mean?
That's crazy.
Because I do believe the quote is that Lear prepares to enter his father's house.
It's exactly that.
And that was part 4 in the Vincus, the voyage out. And Wyatt, what would you call that?
The 1,000-year caravan. Thank you for listening to Oz Hour. Please join us next time as we continue with Wicked, the life and times of the Wicked Witch of the West. Please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Oz Hour Podcast for the latest on everything Oz.
Oz Hour, created and hosted by Blake Stone and Wyatt Swingham, co-hosted by Hannah Geary, audio production by Charlie Johnson, theme music written and performed by Rudy Klobus, cover art by Valentin Lucas.